Welcome to Government Operations and Veterans Affairs Policy Committee. We will not move the bill at this point. We will not vote, but we'll get at least hear the testimony. So, Representative Osmond, House File 2212, where does it go from here?
That's a good question, Mr. Chair. I believe this goes right to the, this doesn't have any financial implications, so it goes right to the floor.
Please. Okay. Well, then once we get everybody here, we'll move the bill. Why don't you go ahead and explain to us and have your witness talk to us, and we can move on from there.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and members. House File 2212 is a department bill, Department of Natural Resources bill. It's a technical bill that's changing a few technical provisions within statutes to make things a little more workable. The sections that will be of specific...
I was going to ask Mr. Shepard why the bill is before us. I probably should do that first off.
Mr. Chair and members, in your packets, I did a memo today that summarizes for all the bills on the agenda the sections that are relevant to this committee. And also in your packets, a lot of these bills refer to some rulemaking exemptions and fee-setting exemptions. And so I had put in your packet copies of those statutes that are referred to, so you can see what the exemptions refer to. This bill, Mr. Chair, sections 30 and 31, section 30 deals with rulemaking, and section 31 requires the DNR to amend a rule using the good cause rulemaking exemption.
Okay. And section 1 is also, I believe, has some provisions in it. Mr. Chair, I'd like to have Mr. Myers from Department of Natural Resources explain those provisions.
Hi, thanks very much. Welcome to our committee, and you have to identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Bob Myers, Legislative Affairs Director with the Department of Natural Resources. As you can see from Mr. Shepard's summary, Section 1 of the bill just is really a technical change with the language to rulemaking, clarifying that existing law, that Section 14.386 does not apply to these fees. The fees we are talking about deal with the electronic licensing fees, electronic transactions, and the amounts that are thereby charged. The other two sections of the bill, Section 30, we have been authorized or granted the power, the commissioner, the previous language said the commissioner shall establish a fee schedule for permits to control or to harvest aquatic plants, I should say. I'm sorry. What we're asking for is that to provide us a mechanism to do this, that we will establish these fees by rule, and also to insert the words control or. So we will be establishing fees by a fee schedule by rule for permits to control or harvest aquatic plants other than wild rice. Lastly, Section 31 of the bill is a rule amendment that allows us to conform the rules to the previous section that I just covered. And I believe we do have an author's amendment to straighten okay. out some language in that section as well.
I'm going to officially call the meeting to order. We have a quorum. I'll move House File 2212 to the House floor. We have an amendment. Everybody should have at their place the 1056 amendment. Is that the one you're talking about?
Correct.
I will move that amendment. The bill, put the bill in order. Is there any questions on the amendment? Do you want to explain what the amendment does?
Sure. Mr. Chair, members, this is an amendment that I worked out with Mr. Shepard, trying to take care of some onerous things that came out of the bill came out of Environmental Policy Committee.
Mr. Shepard's in charge of onerous things, so that works out well. Okay. All in favor of the amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Amendment's adopted. Now we got the bill in order that you'd like. Any other comments? Any questions for members? Representative Solberg.
Mr. Chair, the bill seems to be allowing the DNR to impose a bunch of fees and not coming back to the legislature for approval of those fees.
Representative Osmond.
Is that the impetus of the bill?
Representative Osmond.
Mr. Myers.
Mr. Chair, members, the bill is a technical bill. The fee sections deal with the electronic licensing systems that are out there. If you wish, we can go through the individual pieces of the bill that talk about those fees. but in many instances, it's dealing with duplicate licenses. It also corrects, we covered this in previous committee, though, it covered, it changes the accelerated payment from 4% to 4.7%, a technical arrangement we have with the licensed sellers, things of that nature.
Well,
Mr. Solberg.
Mr. Chair, and I'm looking at the amendment and also page 17, and as we have, I just want to be clarifying this. It says the fee, on the amendment, the fee must be set by rule, and section 16A.1283 does not apply. And 16A.1283, it says, notwithstanding any law to the contrary, an executive branch state agency may not impose a new fee or increase an existing fee unless the new fee or increase is approved by law. Yeah. And so you have an exception to that rule. I think that's more than just technical.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Bosman.
If we could have maybe Mr. Shepherd explain what the impact of this amendment is.
Mr. Shepherd.
Mr. Chair and members, the impact basically is, as Representative Solberg stated, that if the DNR, my impression was that if the DNR were going to set this fee by rule and hold a rulemaking hearing, that then they would not, at the conclusion of the rulemaking hearing, want to come back and wait for the legislature to then adopt the fee into law, because if they were doing that, they wouldn't go through the rulemaking. The rulemaking would be pointless if they were going to come back and ask the legislature to set the fee by law. So, but Representative Solberg is exactly correct that this exempts the fee from legislative control.
Mr. Chair, or to the witness, or Representative Osmond, which fee are we talking about? All the DNR fees, or just for a certain fee, or
it's just the
to control aquatic plants.
To control aquatic plants,
correct. Is this, Mr. Chair, Representative Seifert, as I understand this is the fee that we're charged when. People want to control aquatic plants within the their lakeshore properties, etc.
And Mr. Chair, how is this fee to the witness, Representative Osmond? What is the fee now, and if you wanted to increase it, what would the process be to increase it, as opposed to under this bill? Under this bill, if it were to pass, it would be the commissioner can just say it's going to be. No, it can't be above 750 according to the statute, so we can't go above that.
Mr. Chair.
Right now, you would have to get a statutory authority.
Mr. Chair, Representative Seifert, as I understood it, and I stand to be corrected if I'm inaccurate, but it's my understanding that the commissioner already has the authority to establish the fees and just put them in place. And what the DNR is saying, they'd really rather go through the rulemaking process and have a public exposure on this, some discussion before they do that. They've already been given kind of a carte blanche approval to set the fee schedule and just establish it. And they're actually asking for a little more process in the place. But then to double it up and say that they have to come back to the legislature really starts to make it a time delay where you're wondering as to about the time that happens, they may need to go back in and redo their rules again. So it. That I thought it was a responsible position that they were proposing was to actually have a public process in that activity rather than just having the commissioner just do it.
Well,
Representative Solberg.
I think so.
Well, Mr. Chair, the process right now is that the commissioner can increase the fees but then come back to the legislature for the approval of that. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative Solberg, with me today is Lee Fanmuller, Director of Ecological Services, that will be able to answer those questions.
Welcome to our committee. Please identify
Mr. Chair,
yourself.
Lee Fanmuller with the Department of Natural Resources. Part of what we're doing here is just exactly what Representative Osmond just articulated, which is just making it a little bit tighter in terms of a public process. Actually, last year, we did come back to the legislature and through our statutes increase the fees. So we did it through statutory means through last year's session. But this, what was still on the books and the statutes, is to allow it by commissioner's order, which is really out of date. And what we wanted to do was just update it with a public hearing process through public rule.
Mr. Chair, what's the difference if it's a public hearing in the legislative process and have a vote on the fee, or a public hearing in the rulemaking process and not have any vote by the legislature? The time frame, if you're using a public hearing, is probably similar to the legislative process.
Mr. Chair, Representative Solberg, again, I go back to what Representative Osmond's comments were. We are just updating our statutes here so that it previously said by commissioner's order, and that was obsolete, so we updated it to read by commissioner, by rulemaking authority.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I think it's more than that. I think it's by commissioner's order, but then that order is only in effect when the legislature approves it.
Mr. Chair, Representative Solberg, that was not the case in the past. You could do it by commissioner's order without legislative approval. And so that's why, again, as Representative Osmond laid out, this is a tougher standard than what we've had in the past.
Okay. Any questions?
Mr. Chair,
Mr. Shepherd?
Can I give Mr. Shepherd's, I hate to say it, sometimes it's fact or opinion, but I think Mr. Shepherd usually has fact versus opinion, so I'd like to hear what he has to say about that.
Just the facts, sir.
Mr. Chair, members, and I may not know a specific situation that relates to the DNR, but it, as Ms. Von Mueller said, that before, until July 1st, 2001, the DNR could set this fee by order. In July of 2001, a new law passed that said that no agency can impose a new fee or increase an existing fee until the legislature approved it. And unless there's another, I may not be aware of some specific exemption that the DNR has from that law. But if they're not exempt from it, then their orders would require legislative approval.
Okay. Representative Stolberg.
Mr. Chairman, this is more than just a technicality, then. It may be a different process,
right,
but it's more than a technicality. Mr. Chairman, may I have the liberty to ask a question on page 3? I know it's not in our section at all, but I would like to know why we're removing the sale of forfeited snowmobiles from the money that was normally go to credit snowmobile trails and enforcement.
Normally, I would tell you that we shouldn't do this because we don't want to stray on any of these bills. We'll be here till.
I know,
morning.
But this is the only chance I get.
Is there
to
a quick yes or no answer? That otherwise, I don't want to set a
Mr.
precedent.
Mr. Chair, members, Bob Meyer again at DNR Legislative Affairs. This change is just to conform with current DWI law in Chapter 169 as it's written.
So, what we're doing right now is, if there's a forfeit of a snowmobile for a DWI, we don't put that in a snowmobile account.
No.
Okay.
Anybody in the audience like to speak for or against the bill? Seeing nobody else, any questions on the committee? Representative Osmond.
Mr. Chair, I would like to change the motion, if you could, to have it referred to Environmental Finance.
Okay. I'll move that the House File 2212 be recommended to pass to Environmental Finance. Any other questions? If not, all in favor say aye. Aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails, and the bill is on its way to Environmental Finance. Representative Hackbar, 2265.
Thank you.
This must be DNR day. Mr. Shepherd noted that on his memo to us that, let's see here, Section 4. That's what we're dealing with. Representative Hackbar, where does this bill go?
I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman, was it House File 2265?
2265.
I believe civil law.
Civil law. Okay. I'll move House File 2265 in front of us to civil law. You have any amendments? No? Yes? No?
I believe the department might have a small change.
Do you want to get your bill in order? Is that what you want to do?
Correct.
Okay. Hi, welcome to our committee. Explain first your name and then what...
Mr. Chairman, Kent Lockes, Mo, Division of Waters for DNR. The House Counsel, Mr. Shepherd, contacted the Administrative Hearings Office about a change that would be appropriate on page 3, line 26.
I have it.
and
we got it in writing.
Oh, okay. Good.
We'll get, we got a couple pages here. This would be the 8-2 amendment, correct?
I hope so, Mr. Chair. I haven't seen it.
All right, we'll get it. Yeah. It's coming around. Why don't you go ahead and explain it, and then we'll, before we won't vote.
Mr. Chairman, basically what that does is on line 26, the reference is to section of the statutes that deals with the overall rulemaking for the Office of Administrative Hearings. And what they've done in other other cases, existing law for PCA, who has administrative penalty order, refers specifically to the rules for expedited hearings. And that's what this amendment does.
Questions on the amendment? Seeing none, I'll move the 8-2 amendment. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Okay, amendment's adopted. Now we're on the bill, Representative Hackbarth, with Section 4. That's why the bill is before us. Why don't you talk about that?
2265?
Yes.
Mr. Shepherd, what lines are those?
Mr. Chair, members, it's the end of the bill, page 6, lines 17 to 24.
Representative Hackbarth, or sir, whatever you want.
Ms. Balakas-Moll, I'll explain.
Mr. Chairman, this section of the bill provides that the department would develop a plan before implementation of the administrative penalty order, and it provides an exemption from rulemaking. And this is a similar process that the other agencies that have administrative penalty order have used.
So I don't even have to look over. Representative Seifert.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I mean, I've had a problem with administrative penalties, I guess, regardless of the agency, so I'm kind of an equal opportunity harasser on that issue. But to add insult to injury on administrative penalties, it's the old Roger Cooper question, which is why do you need an exception from rulemaking when we are, you know, in my way of thinking, administrative penalties oftentimes compromise due process as compared to going through the judiciary and giving people the right to air their grievances in court. You're going to beg an agency who fined you to please give me forgiveness, and you really have no redress of your grievances. And I'm not going to go on to DNR examples or PCA examples in my area, but you know, my area has had people ready to get pitchforks out over agencies doing administrative penalties and things. So I'm not going to go on about that. But why do you need to be exempted from rulemaking on this?
Representative Hackman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Seifert, I'll let Mr. Lacasmo take it from here, but I would like to make everybody aware that this is not for the entire DNR. The DNR does not have an administrative penalty order at this time. This is just for the Division of Waters. So I want to clarify that. It's only for the Division of Waters. So I think Mr. Lacasmo does have some examples of why we need to do this.
Mr. Lacasmo?
Mr. Chairman, members, right now we have some enforcement mechanisms. We can either go criminally for a violation of the Waters Law, or a civil restoration order. A civil restoration order, an individual can demand a hearing if they feel aggrieved, so it goes through the administrative hearing process. The administrative penalty order would do that similar process, although it's an expedited hearing, so there is the opportunity for a landowner or individual that receives an order to get review by the administrative a hearings office. So there is an opportunity for review of whatever action the agency would take. And I know Bruce Johnson from the Office of Administrative Hearings is here. He can maybe expound on that if the committee would like.
Mr. Chair, I just have a follow-up.
Mr.
Chairman, Mr. Lacasmo, if I have a farmer who, for better or for worse, is accused of something and we're going to go the route of administrative penalties, does he have a choice to go the judicial route if you want to levy an administrative penalty against him?
Sir?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Seifert, does he... the landowner could ultimately get into the judicial process, but up front he wouldn't have a choice that we issue a criminal citation versus and administrative penalty order. Basically, the reason for the administrative penalty order process, we feel would get a quicker resolution of the issues if the landowner would quickly resolve the issues through discussions with the agency. We can forgive whatever amount of penalty was assessed. That's an option within the bill.
Representative,
Mr. Chair, to that point, you know, the way I look at it, and this is no offense to you, Mr. Lockesmore, Representative Hackbarth, but administrative penalties, oftentimes, you have a farmer and you say, well, I'm going to fine you $10,000 because I don't like something you did. You can hire a lawyer and go through the court system and spend all sorts of money, but how about we just levy $6,000 against you and we'll make all of this go away? You know, I don't want to say that's extortion from the government to the private sector, individuals, family farmers, small business people, but I hear about this every so often. And my final question is, where does the administrative penalty money go when we're done? Does it stay in the DNR, Division of Waters, DNR overall budget, or does it go to the general fund?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Seifert, any funds collected through that go to the general fund. Okay. So there's no incentive for us to levy big penalties and not settle. And our main purpose for this is to achieve restoration of the resource. We necessarily don't want to collect money, and certainly the fines and anything that you would get through a criminal process now don't come to the agency. And our main goal is to achieve restoration of the resource quicker, and we believe easier for both parties.
Representative Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Lockesmore, under the scenario that Representative Seifert was talking about, in the event of a civil penalty assessed against a property owner of, say, $10,000, first they would have to go through all of the administrative proceedings, including the appeals process, before they would be entitled to go into district court and have this matter adjudicated. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Newman, yes.
Thank you. Okay, Representative Solberg.
And Mr. Chairman, I think another point is also when they get into judiciary court, if they ever get that far because of the expense involved, they can only adjudicate what was presented to them at the administrative hearing. Is that correct?
Mr. Lockhart.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Solberg. For the landowner to recover his attorney's expenses, those are limited to the size of the administrative penalty order, if that was your question.
No, that's not my question. If the facts of the case are presented to the administrative law judge in that case, and if there's an appeal and so forth, and then when they get into the judiciary court, I think that, and I'm not an attorney on this, but I think they can only present to the district court those facts that were presented to the administrative law judge and not additional facts that may have come to light. I would like to stand corrected on that.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Solberg, any appeal from a final decision is based on the record, so it's not a new hearing before a court of appeals.
Okay, thank you. And that's an important thing. So in order to even have... before the administrative law judge and you think it's the negotiations, you better have an attorney, and a good attorney, and that expense, because anything that is omitted from the record of the administrative law judge cannot be brought into the judiciary review court. You know, with a passion over the years, I've hated and fought against administrative law judges. Or administrative file. Not administrative law judges, administrative fines. Administrative fines. For a reason. We have a constitution, and I have a right to go to a third branch of government for my redress of my grievances. And I know agencies love to have the ability to be a court, but that's what you're asking for. You have an executive branch that has the authority all of a sudden to come in and act like a judicial branch. You start off with the person that is being accused of not having being innocent before proven guilty, but you start off with a $10,000 fine. Now you got to prove that you're innocent, and they've already proved that you're guilty. With a passion, I hate these.
Representative Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a comment. Representative Solberg is absolutely on the money. We are talking about a $10,000 civil fine without any due process. And once the landowner or the citizen has been submitted to this fine, you don't even get a trial de novo. All you do is you try to get rid of that fine on the basis of the record at the administrative level, so you really never get a shot of being in front of a court and having a trial, let alone the money that you're going to spend on hiring a trial lawyer to defend you. And I think that the comments by Representative Solberg are right on the money.
Sir, welcome to our committee.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Bruce Johnson. I'm Assistant Chief Administrative Law Judge at the Office of Administrative Hearings. I can perhaps just shed light on what the process is in both cases. Currently, if DNR initiates an administrative hearing for restoration, it is heard by an administrative law judge who makes a recommended decision to the Commissioner of Natural Resources. The Commissioner then makes a final decision, and that is reviewable in the Court of Appeals. That's on the merits. If there is no appeal of the merits and the landowner refuses to do the restoration, then DNR must go into district court to enforce the restoration order. What happens in an administrative penalty case is somewhat similar. In other words, the issue of the penalty comes, the merits of the case come before an administrative law judge who hears evidence, makes a recommended decision, again, to the Commissioner of Natural Resources, the merits of that decision, whether the landowner did or did not do something wrong, would be appealable directly to the Court of Appeals from the Commissioner. And then, if the agency sought to collect the civil penalty, it would have to, and the landowner refused to pay it, the DNR would have to go into district court to collect the penalty. So the processes are somewhat similar in terms of the merits. I don't know that the merits are reviewable in district court, and it's not my recollection that they are, but I may be wrong on that. Mr. Loxmo, have I stated the process correctly?
Mr. Chairman, I believe that's correct process.
Okay, I don't know what light this does or does not shed on the issues, but. As nearly as I understand the legal process in both cases, that is what it is.
Okay, so being a non-attorney, and a non-rural person, if somebody comes up to a farmer and says, you're doing this wrong, and they're from the DNR, they say, and here's a ticket, I assume they can issue a ticket, and the fine is, we'll say $5,000, but if you want to go ahead and settle it out, you can give us $1,500 today, and we'll move on. Or they have to go through the whole court proceeding. Is that what we're talking about here?
They go to an administrative proceeding before our office to determine whether the assessment of the penalty was proper. Okay. In other words, whether there was a violation of the law that
and
warrants...
And do you need an attorney to do this? Well, I should put it this way. Is it recommended that you better have your attorney there just to be on the safe side?
You want to do it for
time. Mr. Chair... if I were a landowner and I strenuously challenged whether or not the issue of whether or not I had violated the law, I would hire an attorney.
Okay. And so what we're saying is that we're giving the DNR the authority to kind of be the police officer and the next process without a separation. Is that fair to say, Judge?
Mr. Chair, that would be the case in either event. In other words, ultimately the final decision is made by the Commissioner. On the other hand, I think it's only fair to say that if I were a landowner who was brought into a contested case for a restoration order, I would also want an attorney if I did not want to go through the expense of restoring the resource. It all ends up the same place either way.
in my mind.
Well, we have attorneys on this committee. Representative Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I respectfully disagree with the administrative law judge. The DNR would not be assessing a fine or punishment if this matter went in front of a district court judge. In the case of the civil fine, the DNR is writing out the ticket and they are assessing the fine. And so you now have the DNR without, in my opinion, due process, taking on two functions of government instead of one. And the real problem that I see in this whole situation is a governmental agency with the ability to fine a citizen of up to $10,000. In my world, that's a lot of money. And the citizen never gets a trial at the district court level because the appeal goes directly from a respected administrative law judge to the Court of Appeals. There's never a trial at the district court level. That's my main objective, and I just think it's a serious amount of authority to give the DNR to both write out the ticket and to assess the fine.
Representative Ellison.
Mr. Chair, when this matter does reach the Court of Appeals level, what's the standard of review?
Mr. Chair, is it Representative Johnson?
Ellison,
I'm sorry. Excuse me. That's Representative Johnson over there near Representative Hilty. Excuse me. Representative Ellison, the standard of review, basically, the Court of Appeals can make conclusions of law de novo. In other words, they are not in any way bound by the agency head's conclusions on questions of law. In questions of fact, the standard of review is the substantial evidence standard. In other words, the Court of Appeals may only set aside the agency head's findings of fact if there is not substantial evidence in the record to substantiate them.
So I guess that sort of leads me down the path that I hear Representative Newman going on, which is that the record is in place. By the time it gets to the Court of Appeals, so the property owner doesn't get to really make a record
before a district court.
Right, before a district court.
Mr. Chair, Representative Ellison, they don't get to make a record on a civil restoration order before a district court now because the process is identical in either case.
Okay, Representative Solberg. I'm sorry, Mr. Lachman, you've been waiting to speak.
Mr. Chairman, I think members have leapt to the conclusion that all of these penalties would be $10,000. And we would be looking at the deviation from compliance on a scale and the potential for harm to the resource before you would get to those kinds of numbers. We have to, Section 4 of the bill provides for us to develop a plan, an administrative manual on how we would administer this process. We aren't looking at having the field hydrologists that we have in the department levying administrative penalty orders. Our discussion right now is that authority would rest with me, with the director's office, and it's not something that we anticipate being used readily. But we can, talk about historical problems and the challenge in getting the resource restored. We believe this process would help that.
I'm a little concerned about this, though. Representative Knobloch?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Mr. Johnson, Mr. Lacasmo, what do you do now? Is it a situation where now you have a $2,000 fine, or what do you do in cases like this now?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Knobloch, the process now, if there's an individual that fills in a lake without a permit, there's two actions that can happen. One is a criminal action. It's a misdemeanor. It's handled by the county attorney. So the penalties are $700 and potentially some time in jail. And typically it's a monetary penalty. The other action is our civil restoration order. So we would order the person to remove the fill. And that process goes through the administrative hearing process if the individual demands a hearing. If they don't do anything to remove the fill or demand a hearing, then we have to go to district court to get an order from the court to be able to enforce the order.
and then if still nothing happens, you go back in, you can find the individual in contempt, you could ultimately get to restoration, but it's using a lot of court time for civil restoration.
What is the problem we're trying to fix here?
Mr. Chair,
would you just, can anybody ask me what are we trying to fix here? Especially dealing with the section that we're dealing with, what are we trying to fix here? I think that's the question of questions here.
Judge Johnson, I think.
Judge?
Mr. Chair, I just wanted to make clear for the record, our office takes no position on the merits of this bill.
Right.
I'm
beginning to think we don't either.
I'm simply here to explain the process, and hopefully I'm just a messenger.
Okay, we'll be kind to you. Representative Solberg.
Well, Mr. Chairman, first of all, I want to congratulate the new Republican member recently elected. I like him already.
And he's an attorney besides.
Yeah, and he's an attorney besides, and so that's saying a lot. But he hit the nail right on the head. There's nothing wrong with an agency having to go to district court to enforce the rules. If someone is doing something wrong, that's what the judicial branch is for.
Yeah.
And if for the administration to say, well, I'm going to be the judge as well as the executor of this, it just doesn't make sense to me. It never has, and we get into difficulties. But I really want to have a question on Section 4 of the bill, which is why it's here, kind of. And it says, the Commissioner of Natural Resources shall prepare a plan to implement the administrative penalty order. And so it looks to me like he's got sentencing guidelines type of plan. And then it says there's a 30-day comment period on it, but it's not exempt from rulemaking. So we're having a commissioner's plan, and he's going to set the sentencing guidelines with 30 days of people being able to be out in the farm, farming their field, and all of a sudden realize they got to come in and they've got the sentencing guidelines. I think there's nothing wrong with the judiciary, and I'd like to have a roll call vote on this.
Actually,
bill.
I'm going to lay the bill over. How's that?
Okay.
We're going to lay it over. Thank you. Representative Hackbarth, oh, here you are again. House File 2678. Where does this go?
It
goes.
Chairman, Environment Finance.
To where?
Environment Natural Resources Finance Committee.
Okay, Environment and Finance. Okay, I'll move House File 2678, and that is before us because, let's see here. Mr. Shepard.
Mr. Chair and members, it's on Section 10, which is on page 9, lines 27 to 29, and then Section 13 of the bill on page 11, lines 30 to 33, have some exemptions from rulemaking stated in those places.
Okay, Representative Hackbarth, would you like to explain on House File 2678, those sections for us, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have with me, this is the ATV bill. It's trying to straighten out some issues that we had in the ATV bill last year, some unintended consequences, etc. We can go into the entire bill if you want to, but if we want to stick to those issues,
that's right.
I have with me today Mr. Ray Bowen, representing the ATV, ATVAM, All-Terrain Vehicle Association of Minnesota, and he can explain those issues.
Hi, welcome to our committee.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I'd like to move the bill if I didn't hear you move it.
I did, but you can have that on if you'd rather. It's going to Environmental Finance, and we'll pick it up at the end with you. But welcome to the committee, Mr. Bowen. We're talking about Section 10 and Section 13.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, my name is Ray Bowen. I'm with All-Terrain Vehicle Association of Minnesota. And what the language just before you is actually language that was proposed by the department in their department bill. And what it basically does is exempt the commissioner from rulemaking in those two activities, one dealing with closed forest and the other dealing with just trails development in state forest. One of the things that after we passed the legislation last year, the commissioner, Merriam, has decided that he needs more authority from the legislature before he moves forward designating forest trails. So that's the principal reason we're here. because we're trying to exempt the rulemaking process, because as you know, that typically takes from 12 to 18 months to 2 years. And frankly, we don't have that kind of time. We believe right now we need to get moving on the trail development and get some of those issues resolved as quickly as possible, in line with the legislation that we passed last year.
Okay, questions from the committee? Anybody in the audience like to speak for or against this bill? Representative Lipman.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Bono, one of the strategies that this committee has used in the past is to exempt for rulemaking for a short time and then perhaps do expedited rulemaking after that, or full-blown rulemaking after that, which is, we'll give you a bit of a start, mindful that it's time-consuming and expensive, but you don't get a complete pass forever. You know, sometime you have to undertake rulemaking. What do you think about either of those two ideas?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Lipman, I think in this case with the ATV issues, the legislation we passed last year had windows up to 2008 to try to get the job done, those trails designated. So, and perhaps that's a better question to direct to the DNR itself and Commissioner Holston to maybe answer that better.
Oh, Commissioner Holston, come on up. I know you're there. And welcome to our committee.
Is this it?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Do you want Representative Lipman to repeat his question for you?
It'd be helpful.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, now Commissioner Holston, rather than just a blanket exemption with no time limits, I'm just wondering what you thought about either an exemption for a period of time and then either expedited or full-blown rulemaking after that, so that it's not a pass forever. It's a pass to get you started, and then you'll follow the process from there.
Commissioner. Mr. Chair, members, my name is Mark Holston, Deputy Commissioner of the Department of Natural Resources. Members, I put some things into context here, and there's another bill coming later, I hope, dealing with rules exemption specifically for the department on a variety of other areas. But what you're looking at here is specifically to the ATV bill. This particular one is on closed forest. As we go through this process, we will be going through a public process. And I don't know if it's laid out in this bill here, but let me explain to you the process that we're doing. The legislature has given the commissioner the responsibility of designating trails and closing forests. The commissioner's office in previous administrations has done that just by signing a letter. Those are activities is how the agency's done that in the past. When Commissioner Merriman and myself came in, we sat down and looked at the agency and asked the simple question, what's the process? Where's your process here? And what we're trying to do is highlight, this is one particular area that we are out reviewing, taking 60-day public comment and review on our proposals, and then through commissioner's order, designating the forest or designating the trail system. So there is going to be a public process. There is a public process. The commissioner's order is what's finalizing, but then we're also putting it in the state register. That is more detail. That is more exposure than the public's had in previous administrations around these arenas. And that's what we're trying to do, is bring out a more formal process by doing this. I think we would like that authority to go beyond a short time frame. And so that's why you see this particular provision here. If we want to close a forest in 10 years from now, go through that public process that we've got set up without going through the rulemaking process. That's kind of how we're approaching it.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And this is just a request for some help or information.
Yep.
Representative Hackbarth, or any member of the committee, it looks to me like what the DNR is asking for is that the commissioner be exempted from going through the rulemaking process. And as a generic question, I'm asking why? And the second part of that question is, if we agree with the request of the DNR, where is the protection from the for the public from an abuse of discretion? I'm just sort of generically, I'm trying to follow this, and I'm having a difficult time.
Commissioner, can we help us out here? Yeah. Oh, wait a minute, Representative Lippman?
Well, I'm glad to follow the commissioner, but I can speak. I'd like to speak to that point, Dad, when he's done.
All right, go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Newman, I think, having had a chance to look at the bill much more closely, I think on further reflection, I'm not sure that either 10 or 13 in designating specific trails would actually be a rule. And so I think that it's probably at best a belt and suspenders approach, which is they don't want to later be accused, and members of the public can petition for rulemaking, that this is even within the ambit of those kinds of decision. I don't think that they're getting a pass on all things at the DNR. It's only as to their powers to designate the trails. And as Commissioner Holston spoke just a moment ago, right now they do it just by a letter. It's by pure fiat of the commissioner. The Hackbarth legislation would expand upon that by having at least more notice and comment period. But I think in consideration of that, the agency wants to be sure that while they have a process, that they're not drawn into the expense or procedures of rulemaking in places where I think it probably wouldn't be appropriate in the first place, because it doesn't rise to the level of a rule.
Commissioner? And Mr. Chair, to Representative Newman, the legislation that passed last year on ATV trail designation put a very strict timeline on the agency to review 57 state forests and designate those forests within fall of 2006. That's 57 state forests. That's 4.2 million acres of state land. It's a pretty aggressive approach. And to go through that rulemaking process would extend that mandate that the legislature put on the agency to do that. I just want you to understand what I think. I need to go through last year's legislation and the problems associated with that with Representative Newman sometime.
You, all right.
I guess the only follow-up question I have, Mr. Chairman, if it sounds like you didn't have enough time to get this done, what's wrong with extending it and doing it within the rulemaking process?
Commissioner, Mr. Bowen?
I think Mr. Bowen would like to answer.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative Newman, I think for those of us who were involved in that debate last year, one of the critical issues becomes with the ATVs out in the forest without any discipline. They're obviously causing damage, and what we want to try to do is bring discipline to that activity out there as quickly as possible to minimize the damage. And I think if we spent, I've been involved in the rules process, they go anywhere from, 16, 18, 2 years. So if we're tied up in a rules process for 2 years, that means everything stops out there in the forest in terms of trail designation, getting ATVs on trails, getting, bringing that discipline and enforcement and monitoring and all that, those sorts of things that we need to do. That will all stop in a rules process. So what we need to do is, and believe me, it's a leap of faith as a user out there. It's a leap of faith for us to say we're going to let the commissioner do this without rules. But we believe it is critical. It has to be done within the time frame that the legislature outlined and debated last year. That's why I think this is a unique situation where we have to move and move as quickly as we can.
Okay, Representative Hackbarth, you had a comment?
No. Or not?
Okay. Any other questions on the bill? Seeing no other questions, and nobody in the audience wants to speak for or against, Representative Erickson renews the motion that House File Number 2678 be recommended to pass to Environmental Finance Committee. That's the way you're spoken?
Correct.
Any other comments? If not, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
All right. It's on its way. Thank you very much. Passes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Cornish. 2213. And where does this go?
Mr. Chairman, Judiciary Policy.
Judiciary Finance and Policy and Finance?
Okay. Hopefully. Looks like a tough crowd here.
Well, be careful. Be careful. I'll move House File 2213 to get it in front of us to Judiciary Finance. No amendments, correct?
correct, Mr. Chairman.
All right, and this bill is before us because of Section 4, correct, Mr. Shepard?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Okay, certain employees and for specific laws not objecting to rulemaking. Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, if it's okay, I'll just address this section of this legislation, Section 4. Basically, throughout the last year, labor and management have got together, the DNR, and come upon this agreed or formed agreements within the management between them and the divisions and delineated authority between what's called natural resource officers and conservation officers. This section of the bill addresses the commissioner's authority to designate certain employees to enforce laws governing the use of, and then it lists the areas here we're basically agreed on. And what we would like to do is exempt the commissioner from the rulemaking process to do this. And the reason this would be is because we wanted to kind of keep it on the move. These natural resource officers that the commissioner would be designating would be people that are already serving in present positions, such as foresters or a trail person, and they would designate additional authority and training that they could enforce certain laws, specific laws, specifically authorized under these subdivisions. And so it will allow the commissioner to designate Forester X with an additional authority of a natural resource officer and wouldn't force him to go through this process. There already are a couple hundred of these natural resource officers that used to be called Level 2 in existence. It just makes it formal.
Representative
Spector? Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Cornish, I'm looking at on page 2, there's the exemption from rulemaking on line 20 and so forth. And we're expanding the authority of the commissioner to designate certain employees to enforce laws on state parks, monuments, etc. Don't have to do rulemaking to order that. And then down below it says that employees designated by the commissioner may issue citations for misdemeanor violations. Is that only DNR-related misdemeanors, or can they start, you know, you happen to be at a state rec area or state park and you do something that, you know, are the officers trained in law enforcement? Is it all misdemeanors or just misdemeanors relating to things like littering and I don't know what else they do. Some kid is drinking a beer who's 19 or whatever. Whatever is a misdemeanor, are they all trained and, you know, like a police officer or a sheriff's deputy to be able to do those things? Or are we...
Mr. Chairman, yes, they are trained, and it would be specific offenses. It goes in to list each one and by title. We did have the rule number in there, but there was a problem with listing rule numbers in statutes. We just went to headings. These were specific agreements in each division of the DNR, all the five or six divisions that signed on. It was an agreement between the director of each division and the director of enforcement. It also has been, it got the blessing of the Minnesota Police and Peace Officers Association, and I think the Post Board can't give us a formal endorsement, but they have watched the process progress. Also, the user groups are aware of what's going on, haven't voiced any concern. It's a way of, it's good for both labor and management. It protects jobs, and it also assists management in lessening the burdensome paperwork. And it's a good thing in that it allows these natural resource officers to assist the COs. As you know, the conservation officers are vastly understaffed. But this doesn't take away, in case some of you are worrying about their present duties, this additional duty would only be done incidental to their other work if they happen to see a violation. So they can augment us in relatively minor violations. And yes, they are trained and they receive their training from law enforcement. So they'll know what they're doing. They're not just novices out there.
Okay, so Mr. Chairman, Representative Cornish, to get that crystal clear, on page 2 on lines 27 and 28, where it says that in lieu of arrest for petty misdemeanor violations and misdemeanor violations, they have these powers. You're saying that that's only the ones listed on page 3, lines 5 through 13 and on through there. It's not other misdemeanors.
That's correct. The only other thing it would be is if there is a pre-existing statute from like the 60s to do with timber theft or something very specific. There's a few prehistoric statutes, but they've all been looked at and okayed.
These are specific rules, and only these rules, and only incidental to other work. They're not going to go out and work crews and try to enforce the 169 chapter or various traffic codes, or specifically these DNR tailored offenses.
Representative Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Cornish, in looking at the House Research Bill summary, I note that it indicates that this House file specifies that violation of rules for illegal activities on certain DNR land constitutes a misdemeanor penalty. Essentially, what's being asked of us is to exempt the DNR from the rulemaking process so that the commissioner can put that kind of a rule in place. Is that correct?
Representative Cornish.
These rules are already pre-existing, and to a large part they're enforced already by NROs. We just actually are limiting a natural resources officer's authority to these specific rules. There's a lot of them that we didn't put in there. And the rulemaking that we're talking about is allowing the commissioner to designate the natural resource officers. And yes, they could enforce these penalties, but they've been doing this with level two or NROs for some time on various citations. This would allow them to write a citation, yes. This is we worked over this for the last year. Labor met with management. If you remember, I had a bill in the last year that passed through, very similar to this, to the floor. And then at the last minute, we made an agreement to come together and work out all the details. We had a dozen meetings so between labor and management and worked out all these details. This actually restricts natural resource officers from what in the past they've been doing in ways, because it tailors just certain violations that they would be responsible for, not carte blanche authorities.
Representative Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I wonder if I could ask Mr. Shepard if he could take a look at the House Research Bill summary. Go down to the bottom where it says Section 11-14. And if you have to be more familiar with this bill than I am. I'm just wondering if you could comment on, it appears to me that we are dealing with exempting the DNR from going through rulemaking process in order to specify violations of rules. Am I correct?
Mr. Shepard.
Mr. Chair, members, first of all, I have to apologize. I didn't write the summary, but I see it's wrong. It must have been written to an old version of the bill,
okay,
because there are no sections 11 to 14 in this bill. Second, the only rulemaking exemption in this bill is for the commissioner's designation of employees to enforce certain laws. So the rulemaking exemption only applies to that. It doesn't on page 2, lines 19 to 21.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. That helps.
Cornish, and then we'll go back to the questions. Did you have a comment on that?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I forgot to mention, excuse me, in previously there were misdemeanor penalties in each one of these, and we went through and struck the provision that made them misdemeanor penalties. So I forgot to mention that. That would probably help you.
Okay, Representative Lipman, and then Solberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Shepard, why couldn't what Representative Cornish would like to accomplish be accomplished through a straight... I'm sorry, yeah. I thought he was over there.
I'm sorry.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Shepard, my question is why the object that Representative Cornish has in mind couldn't be achieved by a straight delegation of authority, as commissioners or agency heads do all the time, to specific people in the department. It doesn't seem to be a rule of general applicability, because it has to do with the powers of a particular conservation officer.
Mr. Chair?
Mr. Chair, members, I agree with Representative Lipman. When I saw the bill, it wasn't clear to me why these activities, why the designation of certain people would be a rule at all, even without this language. But again, I may be missing something, because I'm not familiar with the particular circumstances of the DNR.
Mr. Chair, Representative Lipman, the reason for that is, under peace officer statutes in the post board under 626, you need specific authorized authority for people to write citations. It says unless specifically authorized by law. So we conferred with the post board and MPPOA, and we talked about this, and this is the specific authorization that calls for under 626, and that's why it's addressed here in this way, to authorize and to enforce these statutes, or rules, I should say.
Mr. Chairman?
Go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Cornish, I would agree with you that lines 12 through 19, at least as to the first sentence, there's your authorization, and I agree with you on that. The question I raise is why the sentence beginning on line 19 and going through 21 is necessary at all. It probably doesn't hurt, but I think you would have your post board and other authorization, statutory authorization, for that designation. I'm just wondering why rulemaking is even implicated.
Well, the designation, Mr. Chair and Representative Lippman, this what? Section 19, 20 through 21 was made with an agreement with the DNR that to ask to be exempt to this rulemaking process. But are you saying that do they have already, without the rulemaking process listed here, they have the authority to delegate?
If your language from Mr. Chairman, Representative Cornish, in my view, if we enacted lines 12 through the first sentence on 19, you would, and rulemaking wouldn't be implicated. I don't think it hurts to say, and by the way, here's this other thing, a sort of belt and suspenders approach, as we did on the other bill. But I think this is the second occasion with regards to DNR where it wasn't implicated, but perhaps it's so frightening and so expensive and costly and irritating that the agency wants to make clear that they have nothing to do with it, even in places where they probably wouldn't otherwise.
Representative Silbert?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I have some questions about this bill. It's kind of interesting that there's the post board is okay with having citizens that will issue misdemeanor tickets?
Mr. Chair, Representative Solberg, under the existing law, this is what we have to do under the, it says specifically authorize people other than peace officers. And there are old statutes that we took out previously that talk about policing and the authority to police and talks about law enforcement that were kind of archaic. So and there was some belief that the commissioner could have certain authorities delegation to give to level 2 and NROs. And so what we did is clarify it and now make it go through that statute that exists from 626. After 1977, the post board rules came to effect and everything was professionalized. Then they put in that you could specifically authorize other people to enforce statutes, but it had to be authorization and statute. So that's why we brought this before today. And the post board has worked on this throughout with us for the last, I think, 2 years, as well as the
MPP. Mr. Chairman, I find it kind of ironic that the post board, when I had a bill to allow some additional part-time police officers that are trained to be doing such things as water patrol and other traffic enforcements, made sure that they've opposed that bill. Mm-hmm. And those are trained law enforcement people working part-time. They oppose that, but here we can have a secretary in the DNR be given authority to give me a misdemeanor ticket if I go camping someplace and take a piece of wood and burn it accidentally or intentionally. The question is, quite frankly, will all these people be have uniforms on? So I know that they can be arrested. So I don't break the law. I don't break the law when I see the highway patrolman. I slow down. Will these people all have uniforms, or will it be the secretary out there camping and all of a sudden giving me a ticket?
Mr. Chair and Representative Solberg, yes, they will be trained. They will have a uniform and they will have a badge that for now will state natural resource officer. And the violations will be relatively minor ones that won't be criminal code or traffic code. And
Mr. Chairman, misdemeanors are not relatively minor. Punishable by a $1,000 fine and how much? Up to 90 days in jail and up to
$750?
$1,000? I mean, that's that's not relatively minor.
Representative Cornish.
Mr. Chair, Representative Solberg, these these are about the most minor we can get. Like I say, there were misdemeanor provisions in there, and we struck them, so a lot of these will probably be less than $100.
Well, Mr. Chairman, on page 2, line 28, you got for petty misdemeanor minors violations and misdemeanor violations.
Representative Strand, to that
and
point?
No of the rest.
To that point,
okay,
Representative Strand?
I see. Okay. Okay. Instead of doing that. I'm sorry. I didn't read the whole sentence. Okay.
Representative Strand, did you have a question?
To that point.
Yeah, go to that point. Go ahead.
This is analogous to under law, patrol officers and police departments are authorized to issue safety issues for city ordinances by statute or law. So there's certainly precedent.
Okay. Anybody in the audience want to speak for or against this bill? If not, any other questions, any other comments? Otherwise, I'll renew the motion.
Mr. Chairman, just one comment. We've always resisted a state police force. We're now going down the road of a state police force called conservation DNR employees, in my opinion. I'm going to vote against this.
Okay. I'll renew the motion that House File 2213 be recommended to pass to Judiciary Finance. Is that correct, Representative Cornish?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Okay, all in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed?
No.
I believe it passes. Thank you very much. Representative Lindgren and Representative McNamara, get ready. House File 2283. We're going to be dealing with Section 1 and Section 2.
Mr. Chair?
We're a little surly today, yes.
Did that go to Environmental Finance?
No, it went to Judiciary Finance.
The last one?
Yes.
Okay. Judiciary Policy and Finance.
Judiciary, yeah, Policy and Finance.
Thank you.
We'll see where that fate lies there. Representative Lindgren, House File 2283 goes to the floor or where?
I understand it was going to the floor, sir.
Okay. I'll get the move the bill to get it in front of us. Get no amendments. We're dealing with sections 1 and 2. Do you want to explain why this bill is before us, or you want to have your?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, this is Bob Tomlinson. I will let him take care of it.
Okay. Welcome
Thank
to
you,
our
sir.
Committee.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Bob Tomlinson. I'm the Assistant Director for the Division of Forestry within the DNR. Appreciate the opportunity to be before you today. This is a department bill. The bill before you, it modifies the Forest Resources Interagency Information Cooperative, which was created in Chapters 89A, and modifies several provisions in Chapter 90 of the State Timber Act. I'll just go through the sections here quickly and then follow up with questions if that's okay. Section 1 expands the membership of the Forestry Interagency Information Cooperative by adding the College of Natural Resources and NRRI as cooperative members and encourages the university to assume the leadership role for this group. This change is proposed in response to a recommendation from the Governor's Advisory Task Force on the Competitiveness of Minnesota's Primary Forest Products Industry, which worked on recommendations over the course of the summer, and this was one of several recommendations that came from that group.
Okay.
Section 2 of the bill replaces the requirement for formal rulemaking with the publishing of operational standards in our timber sales manual. This allows the department to address a market-driven situation where adaptive policy, we feel, is more appropriate, more timely, and less costly to administer. Section 3 of the bill eliminates...
Well, you don't have to worry about that. We're only dealing with Sections 1 and 2, correct, Mr. Shepard?
Oh, yeah, that's fine. That's it?
That part's okay. Any questions on the committee members for this? Representative Thiessen.
Just for my... what are timber sale allocation standards?
Sir?
I'm not much of a forester.
Thank you.
You may have a tree or two in your yard, though, I suspect.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thanks for the question. We sell timber based on three different ways. We have auction sales. There's a regular auction sale, which is up to 6,000 cords. There is intermediate auction sales, which are up to 3,000 cords. And then there's informal sales, which are lesser amounts of or highly valued timber, storm damaged timber, those sorts of things. lesser highly valued timber, I should say, in storm damaged amounts and things of not more than 500 cords. Basically, our policy and our standards is to sell at least 90% of our cord via auction, and to try and distribute the auctions about equally between intermediate auctions and regular auctions. And so as conditions change with buyers and other things, we might change that over time.
Anybody in the audience like to speak for or against this bill? Representative Lipman.
Mr. Chairman, forgive me.
Mr. Tomlinson.
Mr. Tomlinson, can you tell me about the timber sales manual? Is this like a brochure that one would get if you were going to an art auction, you know, that it lists what is on sale that day, or is it more like a policy manual or a handbook which is periodically reviewed every year? What kind of publication is this?
Mr. Chairman, Representative and members of the committee, it's the latter. It would be a manual that is used by the DNR to when we sit down and evaluate the types of sales that we need to put out on an annual basis, we may make some modifications to it. However, we do also post all of our sales on the website, and we do have opportunities for the public to weigh in. We do a lot of public notifications in local papers and the likes, so that people have an opportunity to provide input into the types of sales that we're selling.
Any other questions? Seeing none, I'll renew my motion. House file 2383 be recommended pass to the House floor. No other discussion. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? That motion prevails. Your bill passed. You're on your way. Representative McNamara.
Yes, Mr. Chair.
You're ready to go. I'll move House File 2263. Where does your bill go?
From here, we would like to move House File 2363 to Judiciary, if I pronounce that correctly.
Judiciary, that's Judiciary, Policy, and Finance.
That's okay. A landscaper's pronunciation of that word.
All right. You want? We are here today for your bill because of Section 39.
Do we have it in the packet somewhere?
It's Kate.
Do we have the bill in front of us?
What?
The bill's coming out. We'll wait.
What's it about?
Kind of dealing with a little invasive and non-attempt species control provisions modified and penalties provided.
Mr. Chair, I have Amendment A4 that I would like to pass out.
You have an amendment too?
Yeah.
All right, we'll get somebody to get the amendment for you. Brendan, can you? Yeah. He'll take it. That's right. Bring it over here, Ben, and we'll get it out to everybody.
Mr. Chair, do you want me to give just a real quick overview?
Nope. I want you to just hang on for a second, because
sure,
we're going to deal with just that section once everybody has it in front of them. Section 39, and that's it. Why don't you just explain Section 39? Everybody, I assume, has the bill and the amendments. Coming out in a minute here, we'll get the amendment. Or do you want the amendment to help get your bill in order?
I'd like to bring the bill or the amendment forward to get the bill in order.
All right. The amendment that you have in front of you, do we have the amendment in front of us yet? Nope, it's coming. You want to explain the amendment while we're getting it out to us?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. The amendment deals with... In environment finance, we had added in a penalty that would make it a gross misdemeanor for the transportation of some prohibitive species activity, and this would involve only the transportation, the import, purchase, sell, or propagate of a prohibitive species in violation. And I'm actually at this point in time getting way out of my league. I'm going to introduce Jay Rendell from DNR, Aquatic Species Invasive Coordinator, and he's going to be able to rescue me here, Mr. Chair, and members.
Welcome to our committee on the 1076 amendment. I don't know if that's really in the purview of this committee, but Representative Lippman, he'll get a copy. Mr. Shepard, does this amendment fall into the scheme of things for us? No, this really is not in the purview of this committee.
Mr. Chair.
Representative, McNamara.
If you'd rather not, I know you have a long schedule. If you'd rather not deal with it, I can bring the amendment forward tomorrow in Judiciary.
Well, this is really a Judiciary
thing, and I think there's a lot of us that sit on the Judiciary Committee that are on this committee. I'd prefer to wait because I think it's really for the Judiciary Committee, if you don't mind.
Can I ask a question?
Yeah, please.
It relates to something that may not be GovOps, I'm not sure.
Okay.
And it might be for Representative McNamara or the witness, but just by paging through, we're kind of adding gross to our misdemeanors all over here, and I'm not real wild if people haven't picked up on that about empowering the government to punish people more for things that are probably considered nonviolent. Is there a explanation for why we are bumping up the sentences on all these people?
Mr. Chair and Representative Seifert, maybe you do want to take up the amendment because I think it's the question is appropriate to the amendment.
Whatever.
I'd prefer to do that in Judiciary. It's really where it belongs.
If I have the Chair's word, he'll work on Judiciary with this.
There's at least a half a dozen of us that are sitting on the Judiciary Committee. It is more appropriate.
Yeah, I think it is, too.
Okay.
I just wanted to ask.
Dealing with the section, then, we're not going to do the amendment, but dealing with the section, you want to explain the section that we are dealing with? And thank you for coming, and please identify yourself.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, I'm Jay Rendell. I'm the DNR Exotic Species Program Coordinator. There are actually three parts of the bill that deal with rulemaking. Section 32 really does not change our rulemaking authority. All it does is change the terminology. We're changing the terms throughout the entire bill in that chapter of statutes. Section 40 gives the reviser instructions to change those same terms in the rules. And then Section 39 gives us direction to adopt rules in order to fix one small part of the existing rules that can't be repealed in this bill because it's not an entire section. Or I'm not sure that's the right term, but it's a subpart, so it has to be changed in rule rather than repealed.
Okay.
So
Representative Lippman has a question for you.
Mr. Chairman, either Mr. Rendell or Mr. Shepherd, I don't understand why, and again, I'm focusing on page 18, line 36, why we need to say in statute that they can use the good clause exception. Because my understanding of the good clause exception is the agency can do this on their own regardless of what we say. Now, again, maybe it's a pass from us, but I don't understand why we need to tell you something that you're, by other statute, already authorized to do.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Lippman, this was added by the reviser's office and was not part of at least what I initially drafted. So,
Mr. Shepherd, can you?
It was their suggestion.
Mr. Chair and members, it's my understanding that the statute that tells them that there is no other statute that tells them to delete subpart B, that it's only in lines 33 and 34 of page 18, that is the statute that tells them to do that. But I think once the legislature did that, they probably could use the good cause exemption without the language that you cite that's on lines 35 and 36, because the good cause exemption allows people to change rules when it's directly in response to legislation and isn't interpreting anything at all. So I don't know if that clarified your question, Representative Lippman. I think they need the language on lines 33 and 34 for sure.
Well, I guess that's my question, which is something which is the province of another committee, presumably the Natural Resources Committee, could direct them to say it would be a good idea to delete item B. But our piece of it, which is you can use the good cause exemption, seems, well, redundant.
Yes.
Okay.
Anybody in the audience like to speak for or against this bill? Representative Thiessen.
What's the rule that we're... Yeah. What is the change?
Sir?
Mr. Chairman, members, it's related to one of the provisions on nets used in infested waters, and what we're doing is moving that part into the statute, so it will now be, it's in this bill and would be deleted from the rule.
Okay, anybody Representative Thiessen? Anybody any other questions? Okay, seeing none, renew my motion that House File Number 2363 be recommended to pass through Judiciary Finance. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Okay, that motion prevails, and we are going to be in recess until 6 p.m. tonight, room 500 North. 500 North starting at 6 p.m. tonight.
Okay, we have before us House File 2558, and this bill will now go to the floor, is that correct?
Right. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, that's correct.
Okay. And Representative Erickson is moving this bill to the floor, 2558. Okay. And Mr. Shepherd, what portions are the bill and why is it before us? And I can't find that sheet that you made. That's why I'm asking.
Mr. Chair and members, this bill has three sections that relate to the jurisdiction of the committee, pretty much all, most of the bill, because it relates to rulemaking. Under Section 1, there's authority to use an expedited rulemaking process. Section 3 requires the commissioner to amend certain standards using an expedited process. So it's the rulemaking issues, Mr. Chair.
Right.
Okay. Regarding that Section 1, do you want to explain Section 1, 2, and 3 of the bill then, Representative Sikora?
All right, what this bill does is references the standards that were passed out of our committee, the science and the social studies standards that were passed out of committee. It does that by reference, even though they aren't part of the bill, and it refers to the rules that had to be made for language arts, math, and the fine arts for last year, and then the new rules for the academic standards for science, for students beginning in the 04-05 year, and then for social studies beginning in the 05-06 year. And those would be passed now and then implemented in those years.
Okay. Is there any questions by any members of the committee? Is there anybody in the audience that would like to testify for or against this portions of the bill? You have somebody sitting next to you. Do they have any comments? You have to introduce yourself for the record.
This is Beth Oney from the department. And, Mr. Chairman, I did have one amendment.
Okay. What is your amendment?
What the amendment does is it's within this bill. It gets placed within this bill, but it really references the standards. And what it's doing is allowing for banding of grade levels in social studies and in science. In other words, the standards have to be accomplished sometime between kindergarten and third, fourth and sixth, sixth and eighth, depending on what this says. It allows a little variety of choice in social studies. In other words, you can band your fourth and fifth grade and then band sixth, seventh, and eighth, or you can band your fourth, fifth, and sixth, and then seventh and eighth, depending on the way your curriculum is set up and your schools are set up in your district.
Okay.
And then science does the same kind of thing. It allows banding of standards so that you can have some flexibility in what you teach at fourth or fifth grade level, et cetera.
That amendment is the A23 amendment. Does everybody understand what that amendment is? And I believe it pertains to what we are discussing here. All in favor of the amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Amendment adopted. Okay. On the bill, as amended, is there any discussion? 2558 dealing with these portions. Any discussion?
Hello.
Seen? Yes, sir. Representative Kahn.
I actually have an amendment.
Okay.
2558
dealing with the sections 1. What do we got here?
23.
Essentially. I keep turning my sheet over in the wrong way. Section 1, Section 2, or Section 3. Go ahead. Paige, you want to pass out her amendment?
Section 1 is the rulemaking.
Well, this, I actually assume that this whole bill is before us because we deal with rules and I think standards, benchmarks, and so forth are rules. So, we're the committee that deals with rules. I don't see how any part of it is not. But, there is this problem of that only the standards are in rule, not the benchmarks or the examples. And but the basic But there's language requiring the commissioner to supplement required state academic standards with grade level benchmarks. And the benchmarks have to implement statewide academic standards by specifying the academic knowledge and skills that schools must answer in this, and the students have to achieve to complete a state standard. So the problem is, the problem is that in these social studies standards, those benchmarks, the grade level benchmarks, and the listing of the academic skills are so complete that the teacher just is going to have to go through them without any room for any kind of local control, any kind of ability to any kind of parental input, any kind of ability to teach them in any different ways. And, I just guess I don't think that that's a very good way to teach people how to think about anything.
Representative Socorro, I'm sorry, you wanted to respond?
Sure.
Representative Socorro, what's your feelings on this?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Kahn, what we have are, standards followed by benchmarks. In other words, the benchmarks relate back to the standards and indicate some of the areas of knowledge a child should acquire under that particular standard. So the standard is very general. The benchmark is a little more specific. And then beyond that, it's up to the classroom teacher what else they teach. And I think the benchmarks are very important, and I think the way the standards and the benchmarks have drawn up are, quite good and grade level specific. Now, what they do in the amendment that went on tonight allows banding in that they have the choice between kindergarten and third grade where they will teach those various standards, and they have the same kind of choice between, for instance, fourth and sixth in both the science and social studies, and then, of course, 6-8 or 9-12. So there's quite a lot of flexibility for the teachers within this.
Representative Kahn.
Okay.
Anyway, aren't we talking about the rules?
Yes.
The rulemaking authority?
Yes, and I would think that this would be beyond that as well, but I'm interested in hearing your views on that. You made a general argument, Representative Kahn.
Well, let me give you a specific one. For example, in one of the things we're going to teach about the Vietnam, you might want to, in St. Paul, where there are these very large Hmong communities, you might want to have a slightly different emphasis on what exactly the facts that you're going to teach about the Vietnam War than you do in, say, Black Duck.
Oh, yeah. That's all right. Dirty Bird is okay.
With respect, Representative Kahn, that is a matter committed to the jurisdiction of another committee, of which I don't sit upon.
Well, the point is that I don't understand. This committee deals with rules.
Yes.
It doesn't just deal with rulemaking authority. It deals with rules. And so I think, as far as I can see, how you use part of the, when we're dealing with standards and benchmarks, part of that authority is whether you adopt the benchmarks. So I think this is within the jurisdiction of this committee.
I don't think so, and I think I'm going to lay it over, because I think it's an improper usurpation of lay over the amendment. Because I think it's an improper usurpation of the education committee's power. Because if we were to adopt that construction, as long as it had to touch upon administrative law, we could suck in the jurisdiction of any other committee, which is not the purview of this committee. Ours is to be guardians of the process of rulemaking, not the underlying substance of rulemaking. This goes to the substance of rulemaking.
Well, then you should vote against it.
Okay. Well, then I think it's an improper amendment beyond the jurisdiction of the authority. I'm pleased to put it to a vote, but I certainly don't want to use valuable committee time. If you're willing to conclude quickly, I'll withdraw my point of order or suggestion that I'm going to lay it over. If you want to put it to a vote, would you like an up or down vote on this? Or
yes.
Okay.
Do we have a quorum?
We're in recess, and so we've reconvened. We're now empowered to do business. Representative Kahn, when we
move to vote. I'd like a roll call vote.
Okay. The clerk will take the roll.
Rhodes. Lippman.
No.
Woodrow. Allison. Erickson. Hawes. Hilty. Jacobson.
No.
Johnson. Kahn.
Yes.
Knobloch? Lesh? Newman?
No.
Olson? Samuelson?
No.
Seifert? Solberg?
Yes.
I'm sorry.
I'm here and Seifert. I say no.
Solberg?
Yes.
Strawn? Thiessen?
Yes.
There being three in favor and five against, the amendment does not prevail. Further amendments? Further discussion? Seeing none, I will renew Representative Erickson's motion that House File 2555, as amended, be recommended to pass and re-referred to the General Register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Aye. Roll call.
A roll call has been requested. The clerk will take the roll.
Can I just ask, you meant
2558, did I not?
I think you said 2555. I just want to make
forgive
sure.
Forgive me. That House File 2558 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the General Register. The clerk will take the roll.
Rhodes. Littman.
Aye.
Udall. Ellison. Erickson. Haas. Hilty. Jacobson.
Yes.
Johnson. Kahn.
No.
Knobloch. Lesh. Newman.
Yes.
Olson. Samuelson.
Yes.
Seifert.
Yes.
Solberg.
No.
Strand. Thiessen.
No.
There being five in favor and three against, the motion does prevail. Thank you, Representative Secord.
Mr. Chairman.
Thank you.
Representative Fuller.
A question. How many members are on this committee?
Apparently, according to the roll, eight.
No.
On the committee.
On the committee.
19.
Mr. Chairman, I don't think you can conduct business with that quorum.
Well, we were in recess, and
a quorum only if a point of order is made.
Yeah.
You guys didn't make a point of order.
Yes. No, you have a vote that showed that there wasn't a quorum present. I think the point of order will be made when the bill is delivered to the floor.
It's certainly my understanding that that because we were in recess and then reconvened, that the quorum originally established is maintained.
That's right.
Mr. Chairman, I think it's maintained for conducting business, but I think in order for us to pass a bill, you have to have a majority here. I mean, the vote itself establishes that it isn't a quorum present. And I don't think you want to have that ruled on the House floor as well. I mean, I've been around long enough when you may have a problem right now.
Chairman, what usually happens is that the bill would get Ellison Hilton.
Okay.
I think the point is you can continue the committee, you can act as a subcommittee, but I don't think you can take official reported action without there being a quorum.
Mr. Chairman, it's my understanding that this issue got brought up last year in the Senate and that operations and committees were allowed until a point of order is made that a quorum is not present. A quorum is established until a point of order is made that a quorum is not established. Now, after the fact of the matter that a vote is taken, I don't know that it matters now.
Every vote,
I think we have a quorum now.
Oh, okay. Get Mason's, so every vote is a test of quorum.
Wait, Lisa?
Well, I mean, as far as I know, custom and usage, and I can talk to Ed Burdick about this, custom and usage has been as if a committee is recessed, you can reconvene the meeting at any time, as long as the chair reconvenes, if it's called the chair, and unless a point of order is made that a quorum is not present, that a business can be established and move forward. But do we have a quorum now?
We do.
Okay, if we want to retake the vote, we'd be happy to do that, just to make sure.
So we don't have an issue. Someone from your side should move that then.
Okay. I'll move that the vote by which 2558 was
was recommended to pass and re-referred to the General Register be reconsidered. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, nay?
No. No.
The motion does prevail.
Roll call.
Okay. Well, you didn't ask that. And
No. On the bill itself.
No. Oh, you requested a roll call.
Yeah,
okay.
The bill itself.
Okay, fair enough.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Boudreau.
I apologize, but please, could you tell me what we're voting on?
Forgive me. On House Call 2558, as amended, the A21 amendment was adopted.
Okay. Thank you.
Further member inquiries?
Can I just ask? Can I?
Representative Houston.
It's not adopted.
A23 was adopted.
Oh.
And A21 was not.
Forgive me. A21 was not adopted. That was my error. A23 was adopted. Forgive me. Representative Houston.
Thank you. And just I don't think it's necessary for the witness, just in general. The process by which the standards were adopted, is that a rulemaking process?
We're beyond that. We're about to take the roll. A roll call has been requested. I'm sorry, Representative Thiessen. Perhaps between now and the floor, that question might be appropriate.
But I think it's inappropriate now, though, yeah. Too. I usually...
There's not been a vote yet.
There's not been a vote on it. It's appropriate to ask.
Well, you just asked for a roll call.
I understand that.
We ask for roll calls all the time and then continue discussion.
But you can still have a discussion after the ask. I could ask for the roll call the minute that you make a motion to move
fair
the
enough.
Bill.
I thought it was that the complaint was as to the quorum. Representative Thiessen, if you'd like to filibuster, please continue.
No, that's, Mr. Chairman, that's an unfair statement. He asked a legitimate question. That's not a filibuster.
I made the motion, Representative Solberg, to reconsider the vote by which it passed so as to afford you a quorum.
Wasn't a reconsideration.
I made the motion that the vote be reconsidered so as to permit you to request a roll call when there was an actual quorum. After the meeting had been reconvened, it was my view that we could conduct business with the originally established quorum, but there was some dispute as a kind accommodation. I moved to reconsider, thinking that we could then indeed vote. It certainly wasn't my intention. I wouldn't have moved to reconsider if we were going to be subject to further questioning by Representative Solberg.
You answered, you allowed one of your members to ask a question.
A parliamentary inquiry.
I would think we spent more time arguing about this than what it would be to answer the goddamn question.
Right.
I mean, when do we not have a member be able to ask a question?
Representative Thiessen.
It's a legitimate question.
Representative Thiessen.
Thank you.
I'm back, Representative Thiessen.
Okay.
What's you got,
Chairman? Chairman, I'd like to hear the answer to Representative Thiessen's question.
I'd like to hear the question.
the question I have, thank you, Mr. Chair, is the process by, and this is kind of a general question, I don't know who it would go to, but the process by which we adopt standards, is that rulemaking? And how does this process, this is just out of curiosity, and how does the process that we followed tie into that?
Representative Sikora.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Thiessen, this bill follows exactly what was done last year with regard to making the rules for the language arts and the math that was done last year. What this bill still has to do is go through, I imagine, a conference committee with the Senate and signature by the governor before it's over. But for now, these are the ones passed by the House, and it allows rulemaking. And this is what we had in the final bill that came out of conference. It's exactly the same procedure that came out of conference last year.
Yeah. So we're just establishing this by statute as opposed to...
establishing the process,
okay.
Essentially.
Chairman, I would renew my motion that House File 2558, as amended, be recommended to pass and re-referred to the General Register.
Okay, and a roll call has been requested. Is that correct? Okay, on the motion, a roll call has been requested. 2558, the portions we were dealing with, be recommended to pass. No, there was, as amended?
As amended.
All in favor, I'm sorry, call the roll.
Rhodes.
Yes.
Whitman.
Yes.
Boudreau.
Yes.
Ellison. Erickson.
Yes.
Haas. Hilty. Jacobson.
Yes.
Johnson. Kahn.
No.
Knobloch.
Yes.
Lesch. Newman.
Yes.
Olson. Samuelson.
Yes.
Seifert.
Yes.
Solberg.
No.
Strand. Thiessen.
No.
I got to go vote again. It passes by a vote of 9-3. Next bill up is Representative Sikora, House File 1789. Here you go. I got to go back down.
Mr. Chair, this is the department bill, House File Number 1789, and it would be, there's no amendments, there is rulemaking in this, and we would ask that it be sent to the General Registry.
First things first, Representative Erickson for a motion.
Yes. Mr. Chair, I move 1789 to pass, and they recommend it to pass and go to the General Register.
Thank you. Representative Sikora, if you'd point the committee to the matters that are within our jurisdiction.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, it's Article 2, Section 8.
Page
and then Article 8. Yes, Article 2, Section 8, Subdivisions 1 and 2.
Do you have a page?
And that's on the main bill, 1789.
Page 13.
Page 13 for members. Representative Sikora.
What this does is it give the commissioner, I think she's had temporary rulemaking authority to do this for the supplemental education service providers that are people that would be allowed to provide services for children who need extra help. So it might be tutoring services, whatever.
Oh.
But there are some criteria through which they would be allowed to provide services. And then there's also statewide testing to set up some accountability in the way we do statewide testing to ensure that there's security and integrity in the results that we get in the testing.
Forgive me, members. It's actually page 22, lines 1 through 13, or 1 through 23, perhaps.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Erickson.
I hate to interrupt, but I need to amend my motion. House File 1789 recommended to pass and go to K-12 Finance.
K-12 Finance, that's the path. Okay.
Yes.
Member discussion on House File 1789.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Solberg.
Just the subdivision we're looking at, the rulemaking authority, is that under the regular rulemaking authority then that would come back to the legislature under Chapter 14? Is that...
Mr. Shepard, might you have a view?
Mr. Chair, Representative Solberg and members, the rulemaking that's authorized in Section 8 is under the regular rulemaking authority. It doesn't come back to the legislature, but it's the normal rulemaking process.
So, Mr. Chair,
Representative Solberg,
then publicized, and if anybody objects or a certain number objects, and it goes 25, then it goes to administrative law judge to conduct hearings and so forth.
Mr. Shepard.
Mr. Chair, Representative Solberg, that's correct.
Mr. Chairman, I wonder how Representative Seifert would feel about the rulemaking authority without coming back to the legislature. I thought we changed that somewhat and had a kind of a policy of saying rules that are adopted by the agency are in place until adopted by the legislature.
Representative Seifert.
Mr. Chair, Representative Solberg, I've had that amendment for probably 2 or 3 years now, and I only have it on bills where the rulemaking is unknown and potentially controversial. From my understanding, these rules are temporarily already adopted and have not had controversy, but the other ones that have come forward that deal with more controversial things, I've had that amendment, regardless of who the author is or what the subject matter is. In fact, last year we did it with Representative Segrin's bill, if you remember right, on administrative licensing of school administrators. And sitting on the Education Committee, since these rules are already public, I've talked with some folks and they have no problem. The groups don't have problems with this, so I've seen it twice now. Since they are adopted, we kind of know temporarily what they are. And Mr. Marcus, perhaps you could answer for Representative Solberg and I, if you are planning on making some major changes to the temporary rules that have been adopted. And that's why my comfort level was, because they're already in existence now. This is just basically codifying them, if I'm not mistaken. So if Mr. Marcus could give us some assurances of that, I think for the record that would be helpful, that when the rulemaking process comes up, we don't see a big docket of new things and a stir of controversy.
Before I recognize Mr. Marcus for some additional detail, Mr. Shepard, wouldn't it be true that one house of the legislature could vote to delay these rules?
Mr. Chair and members, under the existing law, I think it's the policy committees in both houses with jurisdiction could vote to delay the rules till the end of the following legislative session.
Thank you, Mr. Shepard. Mr. Marcus, if you identify yourself for the auditor. Okay.
Mr. Chair, Greg Marcus, Minnesota Department of Education.
Did you want to make any reply to the point made by Representative Seifert or Representative Solberg?
Certainly, Mr. Chair, members. What Representative Seifert said is correct, that the department currently has temporary authority to do this, that has established the criteria and the application process for supplemental service providers. It is one that we believe is high quality, and it's one that we plan to stick with.
Representative Solberg.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I'm looking on page 22, subdivision 2, and I don't know if it relates strictly to the supplemental education service providers. But on as a result of some of the controversy that has been around the Department of Education and their test results, I notice on 11, to ensure security and integrity of the tests and the test results. Right now, the Department of Education has been very ineffective in their test results, the integrity of their test results. Now, does this just make the rulemaking authority to supplemental educational services or to the department as a whole? And if it is, I would like to have maybe some review of their security of their test results and the integrity of their test results.
Mr. Marcus.
Mr. Chair, members, there are, in fact, two distinct parts that you are looking at. The first that we've discussed already deals with supplemental education providers. The second that you have identified is indeed dealing with the statewide testing proposal. Right now, Minnesota law, Minnesota statute 120B30 provides that for statewide tests that are aligned with the new standards, the testing process and the order of administration of those tests shall be determined by the commissioner. However, the commissioner doesn't have any authority outside of that short statement in order to see that these tests are equitably and uniformly delivered and stored, security measures are maintained for these tests. And so it's for that reason that this is being asked. There's a significant expansion of statewide testing, as you know, and consequently the role of security is playing a more important element than it had in the past. Also, because of the fact that we're trying to get the test data back to schools in as quick of turn as possible, we are, rather than always working through district offices, now working through individual school offices. And because you have more points of distribution, consequently, the need for these rules and the security element is greater.
Mr. Chairman, you might be very comfortable in without having some legislative review of the security of the tests, but as a result of the publications that have been in the paper lately, the integrity of the test result, I don't think your track record has been very good.
Mr. Chair?
Mr. Marcus?
Members of the committee, in fact, the point that the department has been making is that the test results themselves are fine, that the test is as it should be. We've had a nationally renowned expert by the name of Susan Phillips, who some regard as the best in the nation, come in. This person's an attorney. They are also a testing expert. They've looked at it. She and her staff looked at it, said the test is fine. The problem recently that you've been seeing in the paper was the interpretation of the data.
Mr. Chairman, maybe to clarify this, we should add a little bit that says not only do we have the integrity of the test results, but the reporting of the test results.
Mr. Chair, to that point,
Mr. Chairman, I'm not going to offer that.
Okay, well, just so that if we had to take that down, but to that point, Representative Haas.
Mr. Chair, I just want to ask Representative Solberg, what period of time are we talking about that the integrity of these tests were not, the method or whatever you're explaining here, what time period did that cover? Was that last year, or was that
last week?
Representative Chairman, what the test were taken?
I think the the reporting of the test results, the integrity of them was in yesterday's or today's paper and news. I mean, I believe fully in the security and integrity of the tests. I've administered it myself. My school was given the tests, and the rules that we operated on had great security of the test itself.
Representative Hoskins,
the test results have been susceptible, and the reporting of them sure have been.
Representative Hoskins, that point?
And Mr. Chair and Representative Solberg, what time period was it, in 99, 2000, 2003? When were those? Well, when did that data come from?
Representative Solberg.
Come forward.
Mr. Chairman, I think it was last year. I can go get the article if you want. But if we are identifying something, Mr. Chair, Representative Haas, of a problem, mm-hmm. now's the time to fix it so that it doesn't keep going forward.
Further questions by the Representative Sequoia, Mr. Marcus, Representative Solberg? There are other members waiting. Representative Thiessen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And from the memo, I understand that page 29 is also within our jurisdiction, whatever article it is, section 5. And I just have a technical question. This is delaying the time that you have to adopt some rules. And I just know on line 31 it says by March 1st, 2004. Does that need to be changed, or was that changed in your technical amendment? There wasn't one, I guess.
Mr. Marcus. Mr. Chair, members, I'm sorry, Representative. As I turn to the page that you were speaking of, I have the date in front of me of June 1st, 2004.
No, but if you look down in line 31, you have to provide some information to people by March 1st,
okay,
2004.
I see what you're saying.
Do we need to switch that to, like, September 1st or something?
Mr. Marcus.
Mr. Chair, Representative, thank you for noting that. No, that part is good.
That's been done? Mm-hmm. Okay. And what happened, and just more generally, what happened with... What are these rules doing, and what's with the delay?
Mr. Marcus.
Mr. Chair, Representative, the delay was that the process that the department goes through to make the rule, the notice requirements. We had a new person on staff at the department who was involved with writing of the rules, and then also the public hearing time. Just it ended up taking longer than anticipated. I do believe that this language of January 1st was put in there from the department's own policy bill that it proposed. It thought when it initially proposed this that was going to be the date at which we could do that. Given that we did have new staff and met some other delays, we weren't able to meet the goal that we had anticipated we could.
But you have developed this notice for participation. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Okay.
Yes,
all right, thanks.
Further member questions on House File 1789? If not, Representative Erickson, or I'll renew her motion that House File 1789 is amended. Be amended? No. House File 1789 be recommended to pass and be referred to the General Register.
Mr. Chairman?
No.
It's finance.
Oh, forgive me.
Education, finance.
Forgive me. As modified by Representative Boudreau. Yes, forgive me. That House File 1789 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on K-12 Finance. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. The motion does permit.
Okay, 24-7.
Thank you for your time, Mr.
Thank
Chairman.
You.
And members.
House File 2479. Representative De La Force, where does it go?
Mr. Chairman, this bill should be referred to the General Register, please.
Okay. I'll move 2479 to pass to the General Register. What sections are we doing? And I lost my sheet again. I'm sorry.
Well, then, okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and members.
3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 9, and 10. That's what we're dealing with.
That's correct, Mr. Chairman. For the record,
explain that.
Certainly.
We just passed the bill. I don't.
I don't believe it's controversial, Mr. Chairman. But for the record, Chris DeLaForest, State Representative, District 49A. I do have Eric Rudin from MnDOT here with me to explain the relevant provision. So, with your permission, I'll turn the microphone over to him.
Welcome to our committee.
For the record, I'm Eric Rudin with MnDOT Government Affairs. There are five advisory committees which were inadvertently sunsetted last year that we need to have extended. Those are Section 3, the County Stated Highway Rules Advisory Committee. Section 5, County Stated Highway Fund Screening Board. Section 6, the Municipal Stated Street Rules Advisory Committee. Section 7, Municipal Stated Street Fund Screening Committee. And Section 10, the Local Road Advisory Committee. There's one advisory committee we would like to no longer have in existence, which is Section 4, the Natural Preservation Route Advisory Committee. And then sort of tangentially related to this committee is Section 11. We're repealing some language on the Major Transportation Projects Commission, which was actually sunsetted last year, but the statute enabling the commission is still on the books, so we'd like to repeal that.
Okay. Anybody in the audience like to speak for or against this bill? Anybody on the committee have any questions? Seeing none, I renew my motion. House File 2479 be recommended to the General Register. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? Motion passes. You're on your way.
Thank you Mr.
Much.
Chairman and committee members.
It's a different version.
Representative Segrin, you're here. You have two bills before us. But we're sorry to be jumping around, folks, but we want to try to get everything in and out. And we're doing pretty good. We have House File 2191 first, or do you want to take 2820?
It doesn't matter, whichever you want to do first. I don't know if I have my customer here for 2191. I can do it.
Okay. Which one do you want to take?
Whichever one you want.
All right, 2191.
All right, 2191.
And that is before us for, I guess I'll move that. And where does it go? To the floor?
Yes, it goes to the floor.
Okay, 2191. Most of the bill is relevant to our jurisdiction. It modifies the composition of the National Community Service. Do you want to explain the bill, Representative Segrin, please?
Yes. Basically, members, House File 2191 applies to an organization called Serve Minnesota. It is the host organization for the AmeriCorps program. It's the federal program that has been in existence since 1993. Last year, this program had received direct state appropriation and was under the purview of the legislature. And last year, the group requested that they wanted to become a nonprofit organization and be removed from the legislative process. That was approved last year. So what they're here before us this year is they want to just do some reorganization of their board structure to make it more in alignment with a nonprofit structure. The organization would still be, all of the members would still be appointed by the governor. The structure would just be changed slightly as far as to the numbers how they would be apportioned. And then we also have a couple of amendments.
Yep, I see them here. And the page can pass out your flyer. Okay, we have the A3 amendment.
Mm-hmm.
And this only one we have. Do you have two?
And then apparently we have some oral amendments that I did not know about, so
all right,
I apologize.
Want to do the A3 first then?
Yes, I'd like to move the A3 amendment.
Well, you can't. I will.
Okay. Or someone will.
Okay. I'm moving the A3 amendment. What does it do this?
All right. All it does is clarify. There was some language that was repealed in the original bill, and we're reinstating the language, but we are just clarifying the repealed language. That's all it does.
Okay, on the amendment, on the A3 amendment, any questions? If not, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Okay, amendments adopted on the bill. Now you have an oral amendment on the bill.
And these are new to me. Apparently the Senate put them on, and I'm going to look at them. It looks like on page 1, line 17, the governor shall appoint 9 instead of the 8.
The governor should appoint 9 instead of 8 members. So you want to change what line, what page?
Page 1, line 17.
Okay.
8 to 9.
All right.
And then if you look on line 26, that number would be 15 instead of 16.
Okay. Is everybody tracking this? I hope.
Tracking okay. that? All right. And then on line 20.
Page?
Page 1.
Line 20.
Where the word employment was struck, they want to add education, comma, development.
So it should read organizations experienced in education development.
In youth education.
Youth education.
Comma, development.
Development and training.
Training.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Does everybody understand that? Okay.
And then...
Yep,
Okay. And then on line 24...
Of the same page.
Of the same page. after the word service, insert our service learning program. Our service learning.
Okay. So it would read a national service or service learning program. Is
mm-hmm.
that correct?
Yes.
Any others?
That looks like that's it. Oh, and oh. Oh, we just have to add an and. Oh, okay. And there was, we're adding Indian tribes back in, so and Indian tribes.
Where's that?
That's on line 24, page 1.
Page 1, line.
Indian tribes was stricken.
Oh, and you want to put that back in.
And, yeah, and Indian tribes should be put back in.
Okay. Everybody understand what we did? Okay. On that oral amendment, I'll move that. And all in favor of that, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? All right, that amendment's adopted. Now, we're on the bill as amended, correct?
Correct.
Anybody in the audience like to speak for or against the bill? Any other questions of committee members? Representative Lipman.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Segrin, I'm concerned about the service learning component we just put in that amendment. Affiliated to school to work and Workforce Investment Act, is that related to... Well, tell me what you understand or how the word service learning is used so I make sure I get the right concept.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Lipman. Service learning has been a big component of the AmeriCorps program. In other words, it is taking an individual and putting them into a situation where they are learning a skill, but they're also providing a community service. An example that I will give you is right now we have a number of members of Serve Minnesota or our clients or customers, however you want to describe them, that are being trained in some scientifically based reading training, and they are working with an educational organization and Head Start, and they're going in and they're actually working with assessing the literacy skills of children in Head Start programs, and they're at the same time they're providing a service and some additional manpower, but they're also learning a skill, and that's what service learning, the interpretation here is the meaning.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, any other questions? If not, I'll renew my motion that House File 2191 as amended be recommended to pass to the House floor. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Bill passed. It's on the way to the floor. Representative Segrin, House File 2820.
Yes, Representative, or Mr. Chair and members, the reason that this is before you is that there is a proposal to create or to request some rulemaking authority for the Board of Teaching because the department would like to create a new licensure specialty in the area of literacy. It would be entitled a literacy specialist licensure. The language that you see before you is the descriptor of what these particular teachers would be learning in a higher ed institution, and the Board of Teaching would implement the rules to follow the language in this bill.
Okay, I'll move the bill, and where does it go from here?
It will go back to Education Finance.
Okay, I'll move 2820, recommend to pass to Education Finance. It's dealing with sections 2 and 4 of the bill. Is there anybody in the audience that would like to speak for or against the bill? Is there anybody in the committee has any questions? Seeing none.
Mr. Chair, I want to make a clarification
Yep.
That the the bill will be changed just slightly. On page 4, it talks about adopting rules to exempt teachers whose assignment do not include direct classroom instruction. There will be a list added to this that will specifically say which areas of classroom instruction will be exempt. But other than that, the bill, you know, won't change substantially.
Okay. Representative Thiessen, you had a question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question was about that provision. Can you just explain a little bit more what that is?
Certainly. Right now, in current law, there is a requirement that teachers get continuing education in the area of reading. But the way it was crafted, it kind of drew in, give me an example, social workers, psychologists, nurses, school nurses, and so we're just wanting to exempt them.
Thank you.
Okay. Any other questions? If not, I'll remove my motion that House File 2820 be recommended pass to Education Finance Committee. Correct?
Correct.
All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Bill's on the way. Don't leave. Representative Earhart, you have a bill dealing with, I believe, Representative Segrin. Is that part of your district with the redistricting 41?
Yes, it is.
Can you be here for that?
Yes, I can.
Okay, Representative Earhart, we might as well get you down here now then. And we'll get the others shortly, so hang in there. I'll move House File 2482. And where does it go from here?
To the floor.
To the floor, okay. You want to go ahead and explain the bill? Oop, I guess you got a hand out there.
Mr. Chairman and members, House File, can you see which it is?
2482.
All right. First of all, I've got a delete off, which you should have in your packet, which is H2482A1.
H2482A1, let's see if we have it.
We do.
Where do we have that?
Yes,
it's in the should be in the packet.
And if you would like to move that, I would tell you about that.
I'll move the A1 amendment. And do you want to just explain what that is?
Well, what we have here in the delete all, we have two dueling experts in redistricting. And rather than create a controversy, the House expert acquiesced to the Senate counsel, Peter Watson, as to the type of language they use. They are describing the same parcels here, and they've assured me that everything is the same, even though they describe it in a different way. Now, here's the problem. You have a map, I think, before you or somewhere, and that map indicates if you would put the blue to the south or down on your desk, the red lines are is the current district. You notice that the horizontal red line cuts through two apartment buildings. When the redistricting folks created this, they took the line and not an aerial photo. The line is a school district, separation between Richfield to the south and the Dana School District to the north. And they assumed that that went across the field and beyond and didn't bother anybody. But what it does is cut through two apartment buildings, and those two apartment buildings now have people on opposite sides of a hallway that vote in different house districts. So to straighten this out, on bequests of the city and of Edina and others, we have gone to the people that do this sort of thing, the experts in the House and Senate. And what happens is they can't just move that line down to encompass the building. They have to take a whole census district. And the blue area is the whole census district. And that now becomes a part of the northern district, which is mine, 41A. And Representative Sebring loses the blue district, the blue outline district. We are still, both of us, within the confines of the 2% deviation. So it doesn't affect us that way. I think there were about 700 people in, that are shifting from one to the other. And that's our story. I have with me the, unless there are questions, I have a testifier from the Atlanta City Clerk, Deb Magan.
Hi, welcome to our committee. You came down tonight. We appreciate it.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Do you have any comments, or do you just for questions?
No, I'll just take one.
Okay. Representative Kahn.
So did that red line then, is that red line fall on the basis of a census district?
No, ma'am.
So then why?
I have no objection,
but what looks as if it might be sensible.
I think it did form the boundary of a census district.
Okay.
Yes.
Did. Oh, okay.
Okay.
Yeah.
It shouldn't have.
Yes. Okay.
Mr. Chairman, did we get her name for the record? I need your name for the record.
Deborah Mangan, the Dynasty Clerk. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Whitman?
Mr. Chairman, Ms. Mangan, maybe you can tell us what the election administration difficulties are.
It's very disenfranchising. This is an elderly population, and they're very confused when one neighbor is in one district and one is in another district. When it first happened, we thought we would just work with it. It became very evident in the 2002 election that it caused a lot of confusion. They went to the wrong place. They weren't able to vote. It's difficult for them to get transportation, to get around. So if we can get them all in the same building, it will clarify and ease that confusion in that population.
Okay, Representative Lesh.
Mr. Chair, and just curious, not having seen this before, when you look at that line and determine that, is it literally, I guess first question, is it literally one person living on one side of the hallway of an apartment building? You know, people, and I said, okay, that question haven't been answered. The line looks like it doesn't go down the hallway. It looks like it goes down one row of apartments, I would guess. Do you seriously use a map like this to determine that, or do you have to do a survey to find it goes through the middle of the building?
I actually have a grid that says which apartments are in which district.
Wow. Isn't that something? Aren't you glad you asked that question?
In fact, it bisects an apartment.
Depending on which room you're in, where you vote.
Wow.
You're a resident of the bedroom.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Representative Hunter. That boundary, Representative Earhart, that drew the red line, you said that was the school district line they followed? They must have drawn that when that was the gravel pit.
Yep.
When nothing was there.
Very good. Very good. Representative Sequin, do you have any problems with this bill?
Okay. Does anybody else have any questions? We have the amendment before us, which basically is the bill. So to put the bill in order, I'll move the A1 amendment, and then that isn't voting for the bill, and then we'll vote for the bill after that. So all in favor of the A1 amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed. Amendment's adopted. Now we're back on the bill. Is there anybody in the audience other than Representative Sebring who'd like to speak for and against this? If not, any other questions? I'll renew the motion that House File 2482 be recommended to pass to the as amended to the House floor. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed. Motion prevails. Okay. Now, Representative.
I have a question.
We're done. You're passed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just had a question for Representative Erickson. I was wondering if this isn't a good time to move the reconsideration of House File 769.
You're out of order.
And I'm in county, so it's a good time.
Would you like your bill to go someplace else?
Yeah.
We can send it to my committee. All right. Thank you. It's great to have a sense of humor. We have Representative Abler's
certainly
bill.
Have a lively group. We certainly picked up on that.
Who's Abler? Representative Abler, are you here? No. How about Representative Lanning? Well, I'll tell you what. Representative Lanning is in 400 North or 300 North. He's not sure. If somebody can run and get him.
page, can you do that? Or if you can see Mr. Representative Abel on the way, that's fine. And then we can just about be finished for the night.
All these committee rules.
What's this?
Mr. Chairman?
Yeah, Representative
Newman. 2820?
2820, yes, we did.
What bills do we have left, Mr. Chair? Just the
according to my information, I have Representative Abler's 2436 and Lanning's 2231.
Mr. Chairman.
Oh, yeah.
If the committee would allow, I could present the Abler bill. It essentially deals with a sunset on the Emergency
right.
Powers.
Well, why don't you go ahead and move the bill, and when he comes in, he'll be pleasantly surprised. And Representative Strand could do Lanning's bill, so maybe we can get them all.
Yeah.
Mr. Chairman, I would move that House File 2436 be recommended to pass, be re-referred to the Committee on Civil Law.
Okay, and why is the bill before us?
Mr. Chairman, the bill deals with the Emergency Powers Act, and it's an act that has been in place, but this committee would be discussing the effect, the sunset actually, on the last page.
Okay.
And I do have the Department of Health here. They have been working on this bill, and it is a department bill.
Okay. First of all, is there any questions at this point? Would you like to say something, Pam, as long as you're here? Welcome to our committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Aggie Lighthizer. I'm an assistant commissioner at the Minnesota Department of Health, and I have handouts if you'd like.
Okay. Page one to run on there, and then we'll get them out.
The bill has several components to it, but the primary reason it's in tonight's committee is because of the sunset date. It continues the powers that were authorized in 2002 as the Minnesota Emergency Health Powers Act. It made some modifications to Chapter 12, which is the Minnesota Emergency Management Act.
Excuse me.
It authorized the governor to declare a public health emergency. When the governor does declare that emergency, if the legislature is not sitting in session, the governor must call the legislature into session. It authorizes the procurement of facilities, controlling of exit or entrance of persons, transportation, and confirms the rights of individuals to refuse testing and treatment. A public health emergency is called for a bioterrorism event or a new or previously controlled infectious agent that is likely to cause a large number of deaths or affect a large number of people.
Any questions? Anybody in the audience would like to speak for or against this bill? Yes, come on down.
Thank you very much. Oh, that's what it looks like.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Representative Abler and I have talked about this bill.
Your name.
Oh, I'm sorry. Twyla Bray, Citizens Council on Healthcare.
There you go.
And Representative Abler and I have talked about this bill, and he knows our concern about the fact that it's not sunsetting, but at least that we're glad that it's it was going to sunset in August, but at least it's going to have a sunset date. The only thing that I want to call your attention to, because Representative Abler said that you were also would be just interested in just generally the bill, so he was going to talk about more than just the sunset. So I'm just going to call your attention to Section 10 in particular, which is of most concern. I'm sorry, Section 11, which has always been our concern about the bill, the part that we would really like to have sunset. And that has to do with the fact that this is actually in the health department. It's not part of emergency management at all. And really what it is that even without a declared public health emergency, The department can take someone and detain them without a court order. They don't have to get a court order for 24 hours. I mean, they don't have to ask for a court order for 24 hours, and they don't have to get one for 48. And not even the police have this kind of power without a court order. And so that has always been our concern, that the health department has this power to essentially pick you off the street without notifying the governor, without notifying the judge, without getting a court order. So we would like to bring that to your attention. We would love to have that sunset, and Representative Abler understands that.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative Hunt.
To that point, Mr. Chair,
you know, if this is a quarantine or isolation situation, if we have an outbreak of a disease and somebody says, I don't want to be quarantined, and he's carrying, then that means everybody in this room could be affected. So whose rights are we violating there? You know, that's the thing. Are we violating one person by detaining them for 24 hours to 48 hours to check and see if they do have a problem? Or does he go out and infect everybody else here and then we all get sick and die? You know, I guess I kind of have a problem with that. And I think there's certain situations that, you know, because of national security or state security, you have to do sometimes. And especially with all these weird diseases, you know, that are going around and how they can be transported and stuff like that, and they can pop up. What do? You know, do you sit and let people run around and spread them? It's not my idea.
Representative Kahn.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative Haas, if we ever got, let's say, a SARS case in this country, we would be in real deep trouble, because every country that had one, including the nearest ones to us in Canada, had a public health system. So, for example, if someone preparing food the lowest level in a restaurant felt sick, they were entitled to free health care instead of coming to work when they don't feel very well because they can't miss a day's work. And so if any one of these diseases that have been so, every place that SARS has been in a country that had a public health care system, and so it was containable. If it ever comes here, the last thing you're going to have to worry about is invoking a quarantine issue, because it's going to spread so fast you're not even going to worry about physical quarantine problems because of the non-existence of a public health system.
Mr. Chair?
Oh, I'm sorry. Ma'am, go ahead.
In responding to Representative Haas, the thing that I'd like to say is that people respond best when they're respected and when they're treated respectfully. If the health department gets to the point where we understand that the health department doesn't actually have to follow due process, doesn't have to follow the due process rights and secure those for people, then there's actually going to be perhaps an attempt on the part of the public to always make sure that the health department will never know anything. So the very best thing, and it has been shown in other situations, is not to have a health department that uses power to make these things happen, but actually uses information and respects the rights of the individuals. Because as soon as the rights of the individuals are not respected, a whole different process happens within all the people that are impacted.
And Mr. Chair.
Representative Haas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do understand that, but at the same time, you know, those are the guidelines that the governor has to set up when they do this, that there is a process, and yet you work with people, but yet if they need to be quarantined, they have to be quarantined. That's all I'm saying. You know, and then whose right is it? You know, whose rights are we violating if we're not quarantining that person? Is it your rights because you have the illness that you could spread, or is it my rights because they let you out and you can infect everybody else around you?
Mr. Chair.
Ms. Brace.
First of all, it's important, Representative Haas, that you understand that this is simply the possibility of someone having something. Anyone could have the possibility of having something. And right now, in law, if you have something, they have to get a court order to, if you have a communicable disease, a court order to make you get treatment, for instance. So we're just looking at the fact here that when you write laws, it should respect the due process rights of individuals, and then the department should work within its own sphere to learn how to deal with people the way they need to deal without taking a power position. In this case, a police officer can appear on your doorstep and take you at only the word of the commissioner. So whereas the governor won't be notified and a judge won't be notified, the police will be notified to go detain you if that's what the commissioner decides.
Mr. Chairman.
Other discussion. Representative Boudreau.
Mr. Chairman, I would just advise members, the bill is traveling. It does need to go to civil law. I think that's the motion. And if you know, obviously there's some challenges there with having everyone agree with a proposal, and it's not something that's comfortable to think about, a health emergency. So I would just advise members if they have concerns that they can work with Representative Abler. I know that he's willing to work with them.
Any other discussion? Nope. Seeing none, Representative Boudreau renews her motion that House File 2436 be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Civil Law. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. The bill is passed and referred to the Committee on Civil Law.
Thank you.
Representative Lanning, please come forward.
So moved. I'll move this bill, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Just wait till it gets over there. Representative Lanning, welcome to the committee. Representative Lanning, where does House File 2231 go next?
Mr. Chair, I would ask that it be referred to civil law.
To civil law?
Yes.
Representative Haas.
Chair, I make that motion.
Representative Haas moves that House File 2231 be recommended to pass and refer to the Committee on Civil Law. Representative Lanning, can you tell us about your bill?
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and members. I appreciate the opportunity to have you here, House File 2231. This bill deals with an issue that I know has concerned all of us in Minnesota, and that has to do with how we deal with sex offenders. And this bill addresses specifically the sex offenders that come to Minnesota from other states. The tragic disappearance of Drew Shadeen and the arrest of a convicted sex offender who is accused of kidnapping her have underscored the need for a careful review of the system in place that we have in Minnesota for dealing with level 3 sex offenders. In researching this issue, we have uncovered some disturbing information and disturbing gaps in Minnesota's system. According to information obtained from the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension, Minnesota has had significantly more registered predatory sex offenders move from North Dakota, South Dakota, and Iowa to Minnesota than offenders who have moved to Minnesota from those bordering states. For example, there are currently 106 registered offenders who have moved in, into Minnesota from North Dakota versus only 62 who have moved from Minnesota to North Dakota. And one might ask, why is this the case? Well, it appears to us that some of the three offenders are moving to Minnesota in order to evade community notification. Let me repeat. They're moving into Minnesota in order to evade community notification. And notification doesn't occur because under existing law, Minnesota often doesn't assess the risk level of offenders moving into the state from other states. This means that if a North Dakota level 3 offender moved into Minnesota, there would more than likely would not be an appropriate community notification, nor would an appropriate risk assessment be made by Minnesota authorities. This simply needs to be corrected. And as a result of these findings, my bill is designed to correct these problems. And my bill does basically five things. First, it requires the Commissioner of Corrections to convene an end of confinement review committee to assess the risk level of offenders coming into Minnesota from another state. Secondly, it clarifies current law requiring assessment of offenders released from federal facilities. Third, it allows community notification pursuant to a risk level assigned in another state. Fourth, it requires the BCA to forward registration and notification information on certain offenders to the Department of Corrections. And finally, it directs the Commissioner of Corrections to determine whether notification laws of other states are comparable to Minnesota's notification law. Members of the committee, I believe that these are changes and corrections that we need to make in order to improve the safety of the residents of our great state of Minnesota. I would call your attention to a couple of the handouts. First, I've given you a copy of the breakdown of where sex offenders have come from, other states, This is supplied by BCA, and it shows the numbers that I cited earlier about the imbalance of offenders coming from North and South Dakota and Iowa. And I've also given you a copy of the fiscal note that we've requested on this bill. And I particularly call your attention to page 6, where it lists the assumptions of what's true under current statute. And it seems to me that those statements really help to underscore the importance of this change in legislation that we're proposing.
And Representative Lennon, I think of a particular interest to this committee is on page 8, where it talks about a end of confinement review committee, perhaps.
Yes.
And Representative Lanning, I see that you have a witness.
Yes.
Do you have, did he wish to present some testimony?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I have with me the police chief from the city of Moorhead, Grant Whalen, that would like to offer some comments.
All right. Well, welcome to the committee, Mr. Whalen. Thank you for coming down from Moorhead.
Thank you.
Could you state your name for the record and give us your testimony?
My name is Grant Whalen. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, for allowing me to speak to you tonight. I've been a police officer for 28 years and have been the chief of police for the city of Moorhead for the past 6 years. During the course of my duties, I have been made aware of a window that needs to be closed in our predatory offender statutes. When an offender from another state moves into our state, they are not given a risk level. That offender also loses the risk level that was assigned to them in the state they are leaving. My concern is that an offender who is considered a level 3 or most likely to reoffend in his own home state can move into Minnesota and not only lose that offender status, but the public loses its right to be notified of a dangerous offender that has moved into our community. Currently in Clay County, we have 115 registered predatory offenders on our list. Of that number, 28 of those offenders have moved in from a different state. 21 of those offenders have moved in from North Dakota. I am aware that some of those offenders were considered level 3 offenders in that state. We are not able to warn the citizens in our county of these offenders' presence in our city. When prior to moving into Minnesota, that offender was subject to notification in the state that they came from. North Dakota is currently going through the process of assigning every offender a risk level. Fargo currently has 9 level 3 offenders living in their city. If you had the choice of living in Fargo, where would you be subject to public notification, or in Moorhead, where you had no risk level assigned to you, what would you opt for? My request is that the state and local agencies be allowed to use an offender's existing risk level as a criteria for holding a public notification meeting if either group determines it is necessary for the safety of the public. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Whalen. Any discussion on the bill? Representative Lanning, any other statements?
Mr. Chair and members, just yesterday at the hearing that we held, just before that hearing, I was contacted by representatives of the Department of Corrections and also the BCA, and there's a little fine-tuning that they would like to see us do in this bill. We're working on that. We have, in fact, just as I walked into the room, I received a draft amendment that we're going to look carefully at and bring to civil law to respond to some of the concerns of those departments. And one of the things that we're looking at as an amendment to the bill that would reduce the number of cases coming from other states that the department would have to deal with in terms of the end of confinement, which I think addresses some of their concerns as well. So we want to be responsive to the department's concerns, but at the same time, we've got a serious problem here that we need to fix.
Representative Haas.
I'll renew my motion.
Representative Haas renews his motion that House File 2231 be recommended to pass and refer to the Committee on Civil Law. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. The bill is passed and sent to Civil Law.
Thank you.
With that, members, I see no other business before the committee. This meeting is adjourned. Oh, all right. Is there someone else?
Yeah. Nope.
Okay, meeting's adjourned.